purpose of this series is pretty straightforward. We have a fabulous and very active and very engaged and very informed office and staff and presence in Washington, D.C. And it is very difficult to find an issue that is happening in Washington on any given day that does not affect, that does not impact, that does not in some way change or make either more difficult or easier our life on campus here. When you think about everything that happens across the span of this institution, from birth to death, every day, somehow something that's happening in Washington today is affecting your ability to get your job done to fulfill your mission. Likewise, virtually everything that we may not think about it, but virtually everything that happens on campus here, in some way, shape, or form, is affected by policies and politics and programs and things that are happening in Washington, D.C. So the purpose of this series, which will be an ongoing and continuing series, is to connect you as leaders at this institution who are making policy, implementing policy, communicating policy with our specialists both on campus and in Washington, D.C. Now, on this particular issue on student aid, I'm certainly not going to try to introduce the topic in a way that Jeff and Christina and Doug and David can do it, but there is, within the higher education world, as each of you know from your various associations and readings, there is no more radioactive topic right now. That has both its upsides and its downsides. It has its upsides because it is putting attention on the many different ways in which students and parents and families use to be able to afford and to make possible a college education. On the other hand, the downside is it's doing exactly the same thing, calling attention to perhaps some of the less savory aspects of what happens in the under the broad higher education umbrella. It calls attention to also to the legitimate and deep concerns that the American public has about the cost of higher education and their ability to afford college for themselves and for their children. And it also calls attention to and brings to the fore the very confusing array of options that are out there for paying for college, for higher education, and the things that we have to do as administrators, as leaders, as executives, as managers, as faculty members, to help demystify this process for our many students. So lots to talk about, lots to do it. We are very fortunate to have four of the most knowledgeable and informed people in anywhere in higher education to help us understand what the politics and the policy, what the politics are, what the policy is, and how we can, and how we as Vanderbilt can ensure that we're able to continue our mission. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Vincent, who is our Assistant Vice Chancellor for Federal Relations and the Executive Director of our Washington office, and your Master of Ceremonies.
Thank you, Mike. Set up here. Well, thanks very much for all of you for coming today. It's a on the cell phone already. it's a great turnout for what, with all respect, due respect to David and Doug, is not usually viewed as a scintillating topic, but it's terrific that you're here. And let me see if I can. Here we go. Okay. When we originally developed today's subject, we gave it a subtitle. There's a new game in D.C. that was a little bit of a tease, just to give it some immediacy. Well, as Mike just suggested, that was before the so-called student loan crisis hit and blossomed on front pages across the country. It's a phenomenon that continues to generate news today. That and other developments have given the federal student aid topic perhaps more immediacy than we'd bargained for. I'm missing this here. Okay, yeah, here we are. We're ripped from today's headlines about lenders and all of that. And don't forget that federal student aid is important to Vanderbilt's bottom line, something all of us here care about, I know, and also to our potential current and former students and their families. Thus, we've got both an important and timely topic, but you've already figured that out, and so that's why you decided to come. Here's what we plan to do in the next hour or so. First, I'm going to offer some general background from the 30,000-foot level and try to place the federal student aid situation in the broader context of what's going on with national higher education policy today. Next, Christina West, our Associate Director of Federal Relations in Washington, we'll drop it down to the 15,000-foot level and describe the current state of play on federal student aid, including the lender scandal. Because in Washington, policy is never made in a vacuum, but is always reacting to headlines and public opinion. Then Doug Christiansen and David Moning will consider these issues from just above the treetops on campus, being careful, of course, not to crash and burn. And they will give us their expert perspectives and tell us what these developments mean to Vanderbilt. Finally, we want to leave some ample time for some discussion and questions. Also, I want to note that it's a little tricky and a little bit of a challenge to find the right level of discussion for something like this. Some of you are more intimately involved than others in student aid issues, but we'll try to make it understandable. But if somebody, one of us says something like mini omnibus bill or long-term continuing resolution, just call us on it. We'll try to straighten it out. The changes in federal student aid are part of what may well be a significant reshaping of the relationship between the federal government and higher education. But how did we get to this place in terms of federal policy? Let me just take a few moments to set the stage. You probably could draw a line in the sand at many different places, but I trace the current environment to late summer 2002, when new and returning college students and their families got hit in the face with huge tuition increases, many of them in the double-digit range, particularly at public universities in states struggling with tremendous budget deficits. As with any self-respecting public policy issue in Washington, the concerns about college costs were quickly labeled in alarmist terms, and we've been living with a quote-unquote tuition crisis ever since. By the way, in Washington, the only thing that trumps a crisis is something that ends with gate, so you need to understand the lexicon there. This is very important. On the heels of the big tuition increases came a spate of stories about lavish spending by universities, hot in pursuit of students who would spend big bucks to attend those institutions. One of the favorites was the New York Times article of October 5th, 2003, Jacuzzi U, a battle of perks to lure students. It told of an arms race in amenities ranging from climbing walls, rock climbing walls, to pedicure salons, to artificial skating ponds, and yes, jacuzzis. These developments serve to awaken a sleepy public from its general ambivalence about higher education policy, and importantly, created a great populist issue for politicians looking for domestic platforms. So you hear rhetoric in D.C. along these lines. America's hard-working, tax-paying families are being asked to pay soaring tuition prices, which have been increasing for years at more than twice the rate of inflation. Is it too much to ask why tuition is going off the charts, to ask for a modest measure of accountability for what is being received for this tremendous investment from our families, to find ways to help ensure that everyone who deserves to go to college has an opportunity to do so? It's just sort of a flavor of what you might hear in some of the congressional committee meetings. Well, who could argue with all that? In Congress, the issue was quickly seized by Congressman Buck McKeon of California, then chairman of the House Education Committee. This, again, was about 2003, who floated a raft of proposals in three general areas. They soon gained the label of the three A's: access, accountability, and affordability. It was the affordability issue that gained the most immediate attention, and many observers were surprised to see a Republican legislator and some of his colleagues propose what essentially amounted to price controls on tuition. McKeon's original controls haven't gotten traction, but higher education was gaining a foothold in terms of policymaker involvement in Washington, media attention, and public awareness. By the time of the 2004 presidential elections, George W. Bush and John Kerry were making frequent references to college costs in their stump speeches. Normally, education is not a part of the presidential races, but it became an issue. And they started talking regularly about the need to increase federal Pell Grants. I doubt that a substantial share of potential voters really know what a Pell Grant is, but a Pell Grant increase is a relatively easy thing to promise, and it sure sounds good. Meanwhile, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman was getting everyone riled up about the American crisis in innovation and competitiveness. His April 2005 book, The World is Flat, tells of the surge in technological capabilities by China and India and helps spur a spate of reports on these issues. The one that received the most attention was the National Academy's Rising Above the Gathering Storm, commissioned at the request of Senators Lamar Alexander and Jeff Bingaman and issued in October 2005. A little bit more on Lamar Alexander in a minute. Gathering Storm was instrumental in getting the White House on board concerning the importance of innovation and competitiveness. And along with other blue ribbon reports issued in this time frame, it placed the nation's future largely in the hands of our research universities and called for significantly increased investments in federal science and engineering research at these institutions. That's a good thing, right? Well, yes and no. Yes, because it has spurred substantially increased appropriations for the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy Science, and other science and technology agencies. But it has also upped the ante on accountability by colleges and universities. Are they turning out the quality of graduates we need to compete in the world marketplace? Are they training the quality of teachers we need to attract and retain bright students in the STEM disciplines? About the same time the Gathering Storm was released, Education Secretary Margaret Spellings announced the creation of the Commission on the Future of Higher Education. A lot of us in the so-called higher ed lobby wondered what she was up to. Just what is her hidden agenda, we asked each other. However, clues started to emerge in terms of, one, her selection as chairman of the commission of Texan Charles Miller, who was a driving force behind No Child Left Behind and a strong proponent of learning measurements, and two, the rhetoric Secretary Spellings was using in her public speeches, such as, quote, "Our universities are known as the best in the world, and a lot of people will tell you things are going just fine. But when 90% of the fastest growing jobs require post-secondary education, are we satisfied with just fine? Is it fine that college tuition has outpaced inflation, family income, even doubling the cost of health care? Is it fine that only half of our students graduate on time? Is it fine that students often graduate so saddled with debt that they can't buy a home or start a family? None of this seems fine to me," unquote. Well, when the commission issued its report last September, there was enough in it to dislike that one of the higher ed representatives on the panel, ACE President David Ward, refused to sign it, based largely on the report's very negative tone and its one-size-fits-all approach to dealing with all of this nation's colleges and universities. There are many threads to all of this, but what you need to know is that in subsequent months, Secretary Spellings has made accreditation reform, different subject than what we're dealing with here today, as a way of gaining greater accountability. And she's made that her primary front in the war on reforming higher education. And you should know that Lamar Alexander has been the leading force in Congress to challenge Secretary Spellings' overly aggressive activities related to accreditation and other higher ed reforms, such as transfers of credit. This is a delicate position for a Republican, but one to which he brings considerable credibility as a former Secretary of Education and former university president. So what has developed over the last few years is a new, complex, and difficult environment for national education, higher education policy. The media are uneasy, the public is uneasy, and that makes politicians uneasy. It also heightens their sense of opportunity. White House, Education Department, Congress, Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate, everyone has increased awareness of and opinions about higher education policy in Washington today. Therefore, when we referred in our invitation to a new game in Washington, it really applied not to just to federal student aid, but to everything involving federal higher ed policy. Nothing in D.C. is considered in a vacuum. So overall impressions about colleges and universities, how reasonable their tuitions are, how well they're doing their jobs, flavor a wide range of issues. We're not talking just about research funding or student aid programs, but about issues as diverse as IRS tax policy for nonprofit schools and peer-to-peer file sharing on campus. In late March and early April of this year, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo tossed into this cauldron a stink bomb that continues to smolder today. His investigation of the student loan industry and its relationship with campus financial aid offices has expanded to various U.S. congressional committees and about 40 state attorneys general. I won't go into details here. You've no doubt read more than enough stories about this, but I want to emphasize just three things about the lender scandal. First, campuses on campuses of bad judgment, unethical and perhaps even illegal activities are limited to a relatively small number of institutions. Most financial aid offices are dedicated to doing the very best by their students and the families with whom they deal. But the offenders do include some of the nation's best known and most highly regarded universities. Second, the lender issue was quickly connected to the tuition crisis by the media, creating a fuzzy but powerful suggestion that tuition increases and cozy relationships between lenders and universities were somehow linked in a conspiracy to screw American families. And third, that these developments are having a truly significant impact on perceptions in Washington, D.C., and are helping shape a very active congressional season on higher education funding and policy. I'm now going to turn this over to Christina West, who will tell you how this is playing out in Congress as we speak, literally. It's all happening just right now. Christina?
Jeff's given us kind of an overview of what's going on in Washington, and what I've been asked to do is go over a lot of the specifics of what's moving in Congress right now with respect to federal student aid. And then Doug and Dave are going to speak a little bit more about how what Washington is doing and has done is going to impact all of us here back on campus. My first disclaimer right now is that when Mike referenced the timing of this event, we couldn't have timed it better. There's about three processes that I'm going to talk about that are going on right now in Congress. The first being the annual appropriations cycle, and the bill that funds federal student aid programs is being marked up in the Senate committee today. Reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which I suspect all of you are familiar with and obviously contains a lot more than just student aid programs, that was marked up by the Senate committee yesterday. And thirdly, a process that I'll talk a little bit about, but it's called reconciliation, and that bill was also marked up by the Senate yesterday. So my disclaimer is that things are current as of about yesterday at 10. Things have probably changed since then, so I may not have the most current information, And the Higher Education Act is a 534-page bill, which I confess to not having read all of it yet. So we're doing what we can right now. These are kind of the questions that I'm going to touch on this morning and answer as best as I can. A lot of these could be a whole seminar in and of themselves, so we're going to get into a little bit of the specifics. I'm happy to take some more detailed questions if you have them, and I'll also try to avoid as much inside the Beltway jargon as I can. But feel free to interrupt me if you've got a question as we go along. Why do we care? You may have heard Chancellor Gee talk about Vanderbilt as a private institution with a public responsibility. We have a responsibility to educate students and prepare them to be future leaders. We have a responsibility to provide access to those students to a Vanderbilt education from across the socioeconomic spectrum. Access and affordability, as Jeff has mentioned already, are intrinsically linked to the availability of federal funds. Although a substantial amount of the aid that Vanderbilt is able to provide to students comes from Vanderbilt itself, which is wonderful, a lot of the basis of financial aid packages comes from the federal sources. And finally, I would say that we care because we are part of a broader higher education community. And as a member of that community, we have an obligation to work with our peer institutions to advance the collective priorities as far as student aid goes. Who are the players? First, obviously, there are individual institutions. An individual institution, though, can only do so much. We also collectively work together through any number of associations. There are what we call the six presidential associations, which means that the chancellor, the head of the institution, is a member of those associations. ACE, the American Council on Education, is kind of the umbrella 800-pound gorilla as far as higher education associations go. AAU is the Association of American Universities, and I would say that that's probably the primary association that at least Jeff and I and Mike work with. AAU represents the 60 top research institutions in the U.S., both public and private. NYCU we are also a member of, and NYCU represents all of the independent colleges and universities. NSALGIC are the state universities and the land grants. ASCU are the state colleges and universities. And finally, AACC are the community colleges. Collectively, these six associations pretty much represent the nonprofit higher education community. In addition to those, there are literally scores of professional associations. Most prominent and most relevant to this discussion is NASFA, the Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. But there's any number of other professional associations. Finally, the other group that I would mention for today's discussion is the Student Aid Alliance, which also functions as an umbrella organization for probably close to 50 or 60 other groups, individual institutions that have an interest in federal student aid. How do we advocate? First off, any institution, public or private, you generally start with your own state delegation. For us, that means the 9 members of the Tennessee Congressional House delegation and our 2 senators. But even within that, we kind of prioritize as to who we go to for different issues. Senator Lamar Alexander, as Jeff mentioned, has been a key player, not just for Vanderbilt, not just for Tennessee, but for the entire higher ed community. He really speaks with a lot of authority in higher ed, and his colleagues tend to listen to him. The number of home runs that he has hit, both on our behalf and on behalf of the larger community, are countless. Representative Jim Cooper is our local congressman here in Nashville. And finally, the other member of the Tennessee delegation I would mention is Congressman Steve Cohen, who, although he's a freshman and although he represents Memphis, is a Vanderbilt alum. And as such, we've really been able to work with his office quite a bit already this year, and he really has an interest in hearing from us and working with us on our priorities. And if you go into his office, you see any number of pictures from his days at Vanderbilt and other Vanderbilt people on his walls. But beyond the members of the state delegation, we also work a great deal with committee members and their staffs. Committees is where a lot of the bulk of the heavy lifting of work gets done. Senator Alexander is the senior Republican on the Education Subcommittee in the Senate. He has his own staff that are delegated to that subcommittee, and we work extremely closely with that staff. Different types of lobbying. What we call direct lobbying is when, say, Jeff or I approach a member of the Congress or their staff and ask them to do something, to ask them to support a bill, oppose an amendment, sign a letter to a colleague of theirs, respond to something that the department is doing. That's direct lobbying. Another type of lobbying, though, is the grassroots advocacy, and that's when folks like Dave and his office come up to Capitol Hill and go in as the experts and go in and talk to different offices and say, this is what we're doing, these are the problems we're having, this is what we'd like you to do. Those are folks from grassroots level coming up and advocating on behalf of their priorities. Finally, we work with alliances and associations, the groups that I just talked about. You can only do so much as an individual institution, but when we join together with the 59 other institutions in AAU, we have a very strong voice. Not only do members listen to things that AAU say, but together we can have access to pretty much anybody on Capitol Hill. Congressman David Obey is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. He's from Wisconsin. Typically, we wouldn't really have access to his office. However, the University of Wisconsin is an AAU member. They obviously have a very good relationship with Mr. Obey's office, and we can participate in meetings with him through the University of Wisconsin. The major student aid programs. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly, so stop me if you have any questions. Pell Grants, I think most people are familiar with. They're kind of the 800-pound gorilla as far as federal student aid goes. The general sense is where Pell goes, everything else will follow. So a lot of the kind of the fundamental lobbying is to increase Pell Grants. Academic competitiveness and SMART Grants are the newest federal aid programs that were established a little over a year ago. They go to Pell eligible students, and they're geared towards students. You have to have a certain GPA, you have to be interested particularly in the SMART Grants in particular fields of study. Campus-based aid programs are pretty self-explanatory. 75% of the funding for these programs comes from federal sources. The remainder is supplied by individual institutions. And that's an important point that we convey to particularly our more fiscal conservative members of Congress, that this is not purely federal money, that there is a very important institutional match. And in a lot of cases, the institutional match is more than the minimum that the federal government requires. Federal loans. These have obviously gotten a lot of attention over the last few months. There's two basic programs that schools can participate in for federal loans. The first is the FFELP program, which is what Vanderbilt participates in. The second is the direct loans. Direct loans are where the government acts as the lender. And finally, there are a limited amount of graduate federal aid programs called GAN. What are our priorities? Every year, generally convened by the Student Aid Alliance, we come up with our community so-called asks. And the idea here is that we all want to be on the same page. We don't want Vanderbilt to be going in asking for one thing and University of Tennessee be going in and asking for something different. And Senator Alexander is stuck there saying, well, okay, but what am I really asking for? So collectively, we come up with a few bullet points. This year, the asks are to increase the Pell Grant to $5,100, increasing SCOG funding, which are supplementary grants to Pell eligible students, increasing the federal capital contributions for Perkins loans. That's what the federal government kicks into the Perkins loans program. The administration has also requested this year and the last couple of years to eliminate the Perkins loans program. Obviously, the community does not want to see that happen. We'd like to see increases for federal work study programs, increases for the Gear Up program, and increases to the graduate level aid programs. So where do we stand right now? This chart, this is one of those things that it was current as of Monday, and now there have been some changes to it. The first column represents the fiscal year 2007 funding levels, which I might add were not completed until February of this year, 5 months into the current fiscal year. The second column represents what the administration requested, what they would like to see funded. You'll notice that they wanted to eliminate the SEOG grants as well as the Perkins Loan Program and pretty well flat funding everything else. The third column is what the House has done at the committee level. That bill has been approved by the House Appropriations Committee, the subcommittee. It will go to the full committee sometime in July. They obviously rejected the president's eliminations of SEOG and Perkins loans, and we were extremely pleased to see some pretty significant increases in the Pell Grant, Work Study, and the Gear Up program. What's changed in this slide is that the Senate has now passed their bill in at the subcommittee level, and the full committee is marking it up at, I believe, 2:30 this afternoon. The Senate subcommittee, our understanding, usually the details of a bill aren't released until after the committee approves it, but based on what our understanding is from the subcommittee level, the Senate would fund Pell at the 4310 level, which is the FY07 level, and it would include a small increase for Gear Up and all other programs the Senate is proposing to flat fund from last year. They rejected, our understanding is they rejected the president's proposed elimination of SEOG and Perkins, but they flat funded everything at the FY07 level. Which means that if that's what stays, then there'll be a lot of negotiations between the House and the Senate going forward as to what the final funding levels will be for FY08. Part of the difficulty that the Senate has is that they had a much smaller allocation that they were given by the full committee for their bill than the House was. The House had a lot more money to play with, so they could add some significant increases that the Senate couldn't. So that's appropriations. The other side of the legislative coin are authorization bills. Authorization bills give you the authority to continue or establish a program. Appropriations basically fund the program. There's a lot of people in Washington that say that there's really three different political parties, the Republicans, the Democrats, and the appropriators. Appropriators, to a large extent, control the money. You can authorize a program and it'll never get funded, and you know, you don't have any money for the program. You can also have bills that are funded that aren't actually authorized. For instance, there hasn't been a foreign aid authorization bill since 1985. Doesn't mean we're not funding foreign aid programs. We're just doing it without having authorized them. So the main authorization that we're concerned about is the Higher Education Act. This is one of those programs that has been unauthorized since 2003. We've been working on short-term continuations of the old law since then. However, it looks like this year might be the year we finally get an authorization bill completed. Yesterday, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, otherwise known as HELP Committee, approved its bill in under an hour by a vote of 20-0, 534-page bill. Senator Alexander, as we've mentioned, is a key person on that committee, and he's been an important negotiator over the past 4 months. And his staff has been soliciting input from us on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. It's been really great to have the staff be able to come to us and say, what would you guys think of this? What would the impact of that be on Vanderbilt? And we've been able to get back to them with our input. Our understanding is the House is likely to take HEA up in the fall. Obviously, the Higher Ed Act has all kinds of different implications for Vanderbilt, going far beyond federal student aid on reporting requirements, cost, accreditation, transfer of credits, et cetera. We're going to focus today on Title IV, which is the student aid programs. In the bill approved yesterday morning, Pell Grants would be authorized up to $6,300 by 2012. There would be expanded access to the academic competitiveness grants and the SMART grants. And then this is where we start getting into some of the fallout from the student loan issues earlier this year. We'll talk a little bit more about this, the Sunshine Act, in a minute, but a lot of those provisions were included in yesterday's bill. including prohibition on aid officials from accepting inducements from lenders, additional disclosure requirements to students, restrictions on the use of preferred lenders lists. This was a big issue. They haven't eliminated the use of preferred lender lists, but there will be added restrictions on how those lists are formulated. Attorney General Cuomo's code of conduct, they've accepted that, and they've spelled out that there will be a code of conduct that campuses will have to adopt. And finally, the school as lender program, which Vanderbilt doesn't really participate in, but a number of schools do, will be eliminated by 2012. And then there's been an effort over the last few years to simplify the FAFSA form, which is what students and families have to fill out in order to be eligible for federal aid. So that's two out of the three vehicles that are currently moving. The third one is reconciliation, which is probably the most inside baseball of the three processes. In very general terms, reconciliation is a process intended to bring spending, revenues, or the debt limit into conformity with a congressionally approved budget resolution. Basically, Congress is telling itself, you have to cut mandatory spending by X amount of dollars by this date. And they don't do it every year, but they have done it this year. They did it last year as well. It also affected higher education last year. This year, it's only affecting higher education. The benefit and the attraction of a reconciliation bill primarily is that there's certain procedural rules that govern how it's considered, the most important of which is it can't be filibustered in the Senate, which when you've got a very divided Senate and a very difficult time to pass a lot of legislation, having protection from filibuster makes it a lot easier to pass legislation that otherwise would be very difficult to pass. So both the House and the Senate have now approved their reconciliation bills, both of which directly affect student aid. Melanie?
Why are they only focusing on higher ed this year?
That's just the decision that was made. Those are the only committees that they decided to give instructions to.
How long is your presentation?
The House bill would cut student loan company subsidies to increase student aid spending by nearly $20 billion. And then it reduces federal mandatory spending by the $750 million that was required. The bill would cut rates in half on subsidized student loans over the next 5 years. You may recall this from the first 100 hours agenda that the House had passed back in January. They've put that provision in this bill as well. It would increase the federal loan limits that is the cap on how much students can take out at any given time. And it would increase the maximum Pell Grant by at least $500 over the next 5 years to eventually reach $5,200. At the same time, it would expand Pell eligibility, and it would provide some tuition assistance and loan forgiveness. To pay for this, it would basically make a lot of cuts to the different lenders by reducing the rates to lenders, reducing lender insurance, increasing lenders' loan fees, et cetera. The Senate bill was approved yesterday 17-3, and it would cut $18.3 billion from student loan providers and then also provide $17 billion in new funding. Unlike the House bill, the Senate bill has two new grant proposals. One would be the so-called Promise Grants, which would kind of be an add-on to a Pell Grant, and then another one to provide increased access to students to higher education. Like the House bill, it would have certain loan forgiveness programs. It would also, and this is probably going to be highly controversial, implement a pilot program that would allow lenders to bid and auction off the right to offer some federal loans. They're going to start with the PLUS loans, which is what parents are allowed to take out. And like the House bill, it has a number of cuts to lenders. One of the big differences between the House bill and the Senate bill is that the Senate bill, when they did their lender cuts, they made a differentiation between for-profit lenders and nonprofit lenders to try and address some of the concerns that the lending industry was expressing about, you know, you're going to drive out of business some of the smaller nonprofit lenders. In addition to those three vehicles, there's all sorts of standalone bills that have been introduced in Congress. There's about upwards of 20 bills that affect student aid. The Sunshine Act is what we've talked about as far as the code of conduct prohibiting inducements from lenders, and those types of provisions. There are continuing efforts to entice schools to move away from the FFELP program and into direct lending. Notably, those were not included in the House or the Senate reconciliation bill or the Senate higher ed reauthorization. Efforts to simplify FAFSA, which has been included. And then Attorney General Cuomo has also testified before the Senate Banking Committee. So the Banking Committee has now gotten their fingers in the pie a little bit, and they've expressed interest in perhaps addressing some of these from the perspective of the private loans. And amending the Truth in Lending Act. Effects of the student loan scandal on federal aid. It's pretty safe to say that lending practices have become the driving force behind reauthorization of HEA. You know, if we hadn't had what's been going on for the last 6 months, I think there probably would be some folks that would say we're going to go another year without a reauthorization of HEA. Given what's happened, I think it's pretty safe to say that there will be a reauthorization bill completed this year. I think it's pretty much a given that there will be deep cuts made in the lending industry, and the challenge is just how deep those cuts will go. Universities have been forced to reexamine their practices and conflict of interest policies. And finally, as Jeff also has mentioned, it all comes back to college costs. Finally, I would just say that Jeff and myself and Mel Bass, who's the Director of Government Relations primarily with the Medical Center, are here to answer your questions and work with you as we move forward with all of this. We encourage you to check out our website. We also have a usually daily newsletter that goes out called DC Brief. There are a couple copies of it out on the table. There's also a sign-up sheet. If you're not already receiving DC Brief and you would like to, we'd be more than happy to add you to our email list. And that's all I have.
David.
Jeff mentioned that Doug and I would probably be giving you a view from the treetops. It's perhaps, in my case anyway, it might be a view from the trenches. And I'm wondering who's trying to cover me up in that trench. But let me just begin by offering a little bit of insight with regards to the firestorm that Jeff mentioned that's been going on in the student loan and the student lender world, as it relates specifically to us here at Vanderbilt. I'm sure all of you have seen a lot of the media articles and attention that's been focused on this. You may have had questions or may have arisen in your own mind, you know, what's going on at Vanderbilt? What are we doing here in regard to all of those things? And let me just give you a little bit of a review on that so that you in your own mind can speak to this issue, or if questions come up and you're asked about it by your colleagues or somebody else. As you're well aware, a goodly part of this investigation, if you will, or this research, fact-finding, call it what you will, has to do with the relationship between higher ed institutions and student loan providers. Things like lender lists have come up, revenue sharing, lenders providing services to schools that result in expenses being avoided, printing of materials, providing web page design, providing opportunity pools of funds that schools can make available to borrowers who wouldn't otherwise be able to qualify for some of those kinds of funds. There's been instances of university personnel receiving stock options, tuition reimbursement, consulting fees, and things like that. As well, some lenders have provided call centers for institutions where a parent or a student who thinks they're calling a financial aid office or an office at an institution is actually directed to a call center that is staffed by people who are employees of that lender. There's nothing wrong with that particular concept. The question boils down to, are those people answering the phone identifying themselves as an employee of the institution, or are they identifying themselves as being affiliated with
with the lender. So it comes down in that particular case to disclosure. It's a lot of other areas that are a little bit fuzzy, but the concept, I think, or the philosophy behind some of this was the concept or the thinking that a lender could, quote, buy their way into an institution's structure in terms of being put on a lender list or something like that and gain an advantage with the borrowers at that institution with whom the or through whom funds might be procured in one or more of these federal programs, and in some cases perhaps more so than not at all in non-federal programs, the whole world of what's called private or alternative loan funds. So there's been a lot of that media attention, and those have kind of been the high points of what has been addressed by Attorney General Cuomo and a number of other attorneys generals, as Jeff mentioned, in up to maybe perhaps as many as 30 or 40 other states. So what about Vanderbilt in terms of all of these various things? Let me just give you a quick little bit of a 101 review. We don't share in revenue. We don't have a call center that is funded by anybody. Our call center is my office. We answer the phone. We've got real people who answer the calls of our families and students, and we talk to real students. We talk to real students, and we have real people at our front desk and our reception area who are willing and able to help folks out. We do have what you could call a preferred lender list that we will share with families. Our lender list, if you will, is web-based. We rotate that lender list. We've got a number of lenders on it with a lot of information about each lender in terms of their products, their services, how they operate, and a number of things that we believe will help families to make good decisions in choosing a lender. That list rotates daily. In other words, the lender who is listed first on it today will be listed in a different order tomorrow because a new lender is listed first every day. So you don't even have preference being given by where a lender winds up on our lender list. Our philosophy, my philosophy, and that of my staff has always been that families should only borrow when absolutely necessary, that they should only borrow to the extent that's necessary, and our job is to help them make an intelligent and informed borrowing decision. None of our folks, myself included, folks in my office, have ultimate power over determining a lender that might be put on our lender list. That's a very specific process, a number of people involved. There are a number of very specific data kinds of elements and other factors that we consider when determining if we even want to consider someone to put on the list or take off the list, depending upon what our experience has been. None of our folks have received stock options or compensation in any way, shape, or form from a lender. I have participated on one lender's advisory board. A number of folks in my office, including me, serve in a variety of ways in our professional associations. All of these things, in one way or another, have been construed perhaps in a negative light. Any advisory board participation has resulted simply in the payment of expenses associated with meetings attended of those advisory boards, and that's been the extent of that relationship. When Attorney General Cuomo asked Vanderbilt to sign on to one of his code of conduct agreements on a voluntary basis, at the advice of our legal counsel, we did not do that. We did not do it because to do so would seem to implicate us as having done something questionable in the first place, things that we did not do. The way the agreements were worded was, we haven't done anything, but we promised to stop doing them anyway. And Cuomo's approach was settle or be sued in many cases. So we dealt with him in a particular way following the advice of our legal counsel, and I think we've addressed whatever those concerns might have been. But this is it's an issue that's going to be around for a long time, and there's been a lot of legislation introduced. Christina mentioned a number of things, but let me just give you some of the names of this legislation, and you'll understand the attention that I guess you could say has been focused on it in some way, shape, or form by Congress, and in some cases the Department of Education. Notices of proposed rulemaking have been issued this month by the Department of Education, and now you'll appreciate this. I'm sure you've all seen various legislative titles given to bills, but here we go. The College Student Relief Act, the College Debt Relief Act, College Affordability and Transparency Act, Student Loan Sunshine Act, we talked a little bit about that, Financial Aid Accountability and the Transparency Act, Student Loan Accountability and Disclosure Reform Act, you'll love this, Simple Information Means a Positive Loan Experience, the acronym SIMPLE. Student Information Means a Positive Loan Experience. The acronym is SIMPLE. The reference is the SIMPLE Act. Student Financial Data Privacy Protection Act. College Cost Reduction Act. And then you have the Higher Education Amendments and the Higher Education Access Act of 2007 that Christina referred to that just came out of Senator Kennedy's committee yesterday. In addition, Ted Kennedy's committee released a 500-page report on marketing practices in the federal family education loan program. So lots of attention, all associated in some way, shape, or form with higher ed. A lot of student loan information there, but a whole lot of other things involved, as Christina mentioned, when you get into the access, the accountability, the affordability issues, the idea of, for just one simple example, of establishing what's called a higher education price index watch. And what that would consist of is developing a formula for determining the cost of education increases at an institution, comparing that to an index, and if your costs increase at more than twice what the index provided, after 3 years you went on to a watch list, and then you as an institution would have to explain and justify your increases. That kind of thing is coming out of some of this legislation. You've got politics going on at the Department of Education as well. As we all know, we're in the final months of President Bush's second term. A lot of political appointees in the Department of Education are looking for new opportunities. I would say the Department of Education is a department in transition at best. A lot of past successes really haven't been recognized, and recent failures have all gotten all of the attention. The National Student Loan Data System was shut down for a period of time. There have been some servicing errors that were brought to the attention of media in terms of what the department is doing with the Federal Direct Loan Program. And it seems like the recent round of what's called negotiated rulemaking ended without a lot of agreement being reached. Secretary of Education did appoint an internal student loan task force, claiming that came about before any of Attorney General Cuomo's attention was diverted to this matter. So you might be asking, you know, where does all of this controversy lead us? In a broad sense, I think it's best summed up perhaps in the write-up that Doug Lederman in an issue of Inside Higher Education recently provided, offering some insights. And let me just read directly from what he had to say. Virtually every practice and perceived conflict of interest that has been questioned in the unfolding student loan controversy can be found to occur elsewhere on often highly decentralized campuses where the interests of corporate vendors and students increasingly intersect with colleges and university officials being at the intersection. Technology companies have advisory boards of college IT administrators. This is very similar to what Attorney General Cuomo has drawn attention to with regards to lender advisory boards, food service and beverage companies, cellular loan providers, bookstores, numerous other vendors seeking to reach a campus of students and employees often offer some kind of revenue sharing agreement. Colleges and other kinds and other institutions accept various inducements or that involve various inducements, which the Congress and the department are vowing to now prohibit in the world of financial aid. Corporate support of conferences, other sponsorships, and other things are fairly common practice as well. So for every story like this in financial aid, there's probably a story for other areas in higher ed. And I think, you know, the next shoe might fall in some of those other areas. I don't know that that's the case, but I think in the bigger picture to which Jeff has referred and what's going on, I think there is a very likely possibility of some attention being directed. Right at the present time at Vanderbilt, I would like to say it's going to be pretty much business as usual with some minor changes being made and ultimately other changes perhaps depending upon legislative outcomes. What we've been doing is basically what many aspects of these codes of conduct say need to be done. Talked with a reporter from the USA Today one day, and she asked me if Vanderbilt was going to abide by our National Association Code of Conduct and ethical principles that have been recently put forth. And I said, yeah, that's easy. We're already doing that. And when you look at most of what's been proposed, beyond some of the idiosyncrasies or the few idiosyncrasies that are there, Vanderbilt isn't going to have to change anything to be, quote, in compliance, if you want to use that word. However, when you look at what is proposed in some of these many legislative arenas and through these bills, obviously there could be change that we will have to make as a result of the legislation that gets passed. There could be some things, unintended consequences, I think, that come out of all of this, and that could be unfortunate. I think some of the biggest and the negative impact most likely felt in all of this is going to be by the neediest students. The neediest students are typically the students that need our help the most. They're the hardest to reach. If you remembered some of the things that Christina mentioned about lender reimbursement, if you will, or their income stream being reduced as a result of this legislation, that's going to take a toll in the form of lenders cutting back on the benefits that they offer to borrowers. The bottom line is going to be that some of the fees that lenders pay on behalf of students, some of the benefits they offer for students who make on-time payments during repayment, some of the interest rate reductions that lenders offer, these are all going to disappear. And generally speaking, if the lenders are going to have to foot the bill, they're going to stop passing on some of these benefits to the borrowers. My guess is, and this is just my own bias, is that the lenders will be able to continue to operate profitably, but they won't be sharing profits in the form of benefits to borrowers. And if that happens, then the students and the parents are ultimately going to suffer in all of this. My guess is that we could see more direct to student or direct to consumer marketing. It's already a confusing world out there, but if we're prohibited from doing certain things in a positive way, lenders are going to jump on that bandwagon and start doing some direct-to-consumer marketing. If we aren't able to help families by offering insights in terms of lenderness and say, you know, figure it out for yourself, I don't know if anybody's done this, but you go out and if you Google on student loans, you get millions of hits So to tell a family, figure it out, do it on your own, I don't think is going to be helpful to them at all. I think you're going to see more governmental involvement, layers of bureaucracy that become inserted between the students and the families and institutions of higher education. And I don't know about you, but every time that the federal government has inserted itself further into the way I do business in my office, it only gets worse. It gets more complicated and confusing for everybody. There's probably other things as well that can evolve out of this. I hope that doesn't happen, but those are some of the possibilities. Thank you.
Good job. Well, we will move quickly here with the hour. If you'll bear with us so we can kind of get through a little of this, and hopefully we can get a question or two in. First of all, as we've all talked today, there's been a great deal of stress put on the financial aid industry around the United States. It's translating to questions to our most needy students. And we need to be thinking about these ramifications and what that means. I wanted to point out very directly Clyde and Brent and Dave, who have done a superb job in their staff of getting all of the new student aid out, all of the continuing aid student out, all of our graduate aid and those programs, and still that pack over here is just the Attorney General for Tennessee, and then we have Cuomo's, which was this big as well. Huge undertaking, and they've done a superb job in keeping us afloat. Also, Christina and Jeff have been almost daily emails to us as we're figuring out what does all of this mean as these shoe continues to drop here. And Jeff said early on, this will not be a big bang and then we'll be done. It's going to be a drip, drip, drip. I don't know if you remember those exact comments, but I think this is going to go for quite some time. As Christine, Mike and Jeff both gave us general overviews of where we're headed. Christina walked through some very specific legislation that is coming in. Dave started in looking at the impact on our current students. My role here today is to shed some light on Vanderbilt and what we have been doing good and what we've been doing for our students, and also looking at some future demographics and what does that mean as we think about aid policy in the future, that we hope the federal and state policymakers will really look also at this broader issue of access and affordability for the wave of new students that I'm going to talk about in just a moment. As you know, access and affordability is Vanderbilt's commitment. To that end, there are two important points that reflect this dedication and commitment. First, the Office of Undergraduate Admissions, and most of my remarks will be based at the undergraduate level, although I will flow over briefly into some of our professional and graduate programs. The Office of Undergraduate Admissions is committed to need-blind admissions. That means we do not take into account the ability to pay when we make an admissions offer. That is fairly customary in the United States. Probably 95%, 98% of the universities in the United States have a need-blind policy. But the second component is Vanderbilt commits to meet 100% of a family's demonstrated need for the admitted student. So what we start with is essentially an open checkbook when we're going through the admissions process, looking at huge historical data patterns to determine what's going to happen at the outcome, because we do not want finances to be a barrier to Vanderbilt University, because the student is academically prepared, has every right to be here, and will add to the value in our community if they can't pay for it. That is a superb promise. There are only about 25 to 30 schools in the United States today that have both of those components. Meet full demonstrated need and are 100% need blind. What a wonderful blessing for all of us to work at a university that's looking at enriching and building a community and not letting cost be a factor. Because of this investment and commitment, many students find that they often pay no more to attend Vanderbilt than they would to attend a college or a university at a lower cost. Let me give you an example. Let's take a large state public land grant institution. And if you equalize their in-state and out-of-state tuition and total cost, we'll say they're $25,000. This is a real school. That average indebtedness of the student graduating from that institution is about $19,400. Now we're going to look at Vanderbilt, which total cost is approximately $50,000. The average indebtedness of the student graduating, the senior student graduating from Vanderbilt this year was $19,800. So only $400 more in need-based loan, but yet it was we're $25,000 more in cost. What they're saying is we're trying to make sure students aren't making decisions on how much loan they can take, to what career they want to explore, to what avenue if they want to do extra things such as study abroad or other opportunities. But that's a huge public policy debate. A land-grant institution at that level and of indebtedness versus a private institution, I think right back to the opening comment with Chancellor Gee, we're a private institution, but we carry a heavy public trust and a heavily public, not burden, but responsibility. These two commitments combined place Vanderbilt among a very small group of students. Let me give you some institutions. Let me give you a few statistics about Vanderbilt right now. First of all, I'll pull this up so I can read it quicker because of the time. For 06-07, with our reconciled budget, the financial aid office processed approximately $206 million in financial aid. That includes all aid from all sources and in all forms for our undergraduates, graduate, and professional students, with the exception of those in the medical school. The medical school has its own separate autonomous student aid office. The $206 million breaks down to approximately $128 million going to undergraduates and $78 million going to graduate and professional students. At the undergraduate level, the sources of that $128 million in overall total aid break out as follows. First of all, 73% come from Vanderbilt programs, of which the high majority of that is the commitment of our four undergraduate deans, who funnel funds back in to the financial aid office so that we have the ability to have access and affordability for our lowest income students. 7% are federal, 14% are federal, meaning loan programs, 3 come from state programs, and 4% from other miscellaneous programs. It is interesting to note that when one compares Vanderbilt need-based aid versus grant funds to the federal need-based aid program, Vanderbilt provides approximately $21 for every $1 of federal funds. That is a phenomenal statement when you think of those dollars of need-based aid. As we think about the future and funding policy at the federal, state, and institutional level, we like to look into kind of future demographics as we think about this. Today's 10th graders are projected to be the largest high school graduating class in 2009 in U.S. history. Between 1995 and 2015, 20% more students are projected to enroll in college, reaching 16 million, assuming at the 66% participation rate that we have today. Students of color will represent 80% of the increase in college-age students between 95 and 2015. And nearly 50% of that growth will be among Hispanic students. Among minority students, 45% will come from families with the lowest expected family contribution. So our largest public policy question today is how we continue to fund the wave of the demographics of this new students at the lowest income brackets in the United States. As a matter of public policy relative to access and affordability, we in the higher education community need to be thinking about access and access 5 and 10 and 15 years from now. I hope we don't get derailed. While I'm very sympathetic and understand what's happening with the loan controversy, that we don't get derailed from the real issue of opportunity for our students and for students in the United States. Let me share a few statistics with you. 1 in 17 students will earn a BA degree by the age of 24 if they come from a family of $35,000 or less. 1 in 10 will earn a BA degree by the time they're 24 if they come from a family between $36,000 and $60,000. 1 in 4 will earn a BA degree by the age of 24 if they come from a family of $61,000 to $80,000. And 1 in 2 will earn a BA degree by the age of 24 if they come from a family of $85,000 or higher. We have a commitment we need to be out there helping these students. These statistics nationally don't bode well for us at all. current perception of college costs and ability to pay. I wanted to share something else that came from the Chronicle of Higher Education survey of public opinion, and 82% of our middle-class family, it's very difficult for a middle-class family to afford a college education. 82% of our middle people responded to that question affirmatively on their perception of cost and ability. High-cost colleges and universities are generally also of higher quality. Almost half felt that. Many college students have incurred too much debt for their college education. 88% of this survey of parents out in the United States feel that. Those are huge things when we talk about public trust and what's happening here. I wanted to close very quickly now with to share with you, we can commissioned a research study research consortium we belong to, and we wanted to look at the brand of Vanderbilt and how students in 10th and 11th grade, current rising 10th graders and moving into 11th grade, so just starting their junior year in high school or their sophomore year this coming fall, what they knew about Vanderbilt, what their perceptions of Vanderbilt, and this will be a full study we're happy to share with all of you. We had almost 5,000 respondents. It's a huge response. It's national in origin. It's all over across our demographic shift. And these students had to be students we had not recruited yet because we didn't want to be giving them information about this. And let me read this to you. A large portion of students are sensitive to the cost of Vanderbilt's institution, and many, 89% of those who choose Vanderbilt as their top choice indicate that they would consider a second choice school, mostly if the second school is more affordable or offered better scholarships. Now let me phrase that again. Vanderbilt is in a unique position that it meets 100% of student need and can make a compelling case on both affordability and academic quality. Yet only 9% of these students had any idea of our aid policy. That is horrible for us. Only 9% nationally. So we've got a lot of perceptions out there that we've got to change when we think about what all this federal legislation, this issue on the loan and scandal, that it doesn't derail us from this. And then, and finally, we are re-looking at 25 of our publications. Amy Smith is here today, who leads that area. And every new publication that we work with Mike Schoenfeld's area on has a message about aid, 100% need blind, meeting full demonstrated need. This is the new view book for next year. This was the search piece that was just sent out to juniors in high school. But we've had to rethink this so students, this wave of students coming through, don't feel like they don't have the right to be at a top 20 institution in the United States. We also have been selected to be one of about 20 schools in the United States to participate in a low-income pilot study. And what this is in the College Board, you can buy names that are purchase names that are 10th graders, 11th graders that have taken certain tests, if you will. There's a real debate on the admissions side. The admissions folks want to have dollar-related income variables when they make their search of these prospective students or cold calls. The financial aid world doesn't want to have that available because of the issues surrounding someone might only want to recruit high-pay students, not low-income students. So we've been selected because Vanderbilt, over the last 5 years, has moved from about 40% of our students receiving our entering class receiving some form of need-based aid to almost 46% of the entering class. We have a commitment to this. It's demonstrated. We had to petition to participate. And we now are going to have the ability to have names of low-income students through an algorithm with the College Board where we can set up a whole communication flow starting 18 months out, working with these students as we move them through. I hope those are the types of things we can be thinking about when we think about this discussion today and how do we move this federal issue that's swirling around, this controversy with the whole lender industry, to what our number one goal is delivering a quality education to students and making it so that if they can't afford it because of their personal means, but they have the academic preparedness to be here, we can take them.